Ready to find your next favorite podcast? Spotify makes it easier than ever to discover new favorites by previewing short audio clips before committing to a full listen. You can even watch some podcasts with video or just keep playing audio in the background. It's everything you want in one app. Music, podcasts, and audiobooks across any device. Play anytime, anywhere, any way you'd like with Spotify. Try today.
Walking through the darkened forest, May paused and looked up into the trees. Even though the small gray bird was obscured in the shadows, her song swelled like a symphony around May. She tried to hum along with the bird for a moment, but then stopped and smiled sheepishly to herself. It was no use in trying. No human could even come close to capturing the melody of the nightingale's song. The forest path was overgrown and sometimes hard to navigate, since no one ever came this way anymore. Her mother was too ill to leave her bed now, and the villagers never strayed into the woods farther than they needed to. But May wasn't afraid, for the nightingale was always there, singing. Sometimes the bird's song was cheery and warm, and other times, like this morning, the song was mournful, haunting even. May hurried along as an amber glow crept over the horizon, announcing the rising sun. She needed to hurry. She was needed in the palace, where she worked as a scullery maid and could not be late. Her mother relied on the scraps of food she saved in the evenings after the emperor and all of his attendants were fed. The nightingale circled overhead before sailing off, and May smiled as the sweet song faded in the distance. Despite her troubles, May took great comfort in the true beauty of the world around her. I'm Vanessa Richardson. You're listening to Tales. Today, I'll be sharing the dark, enchanting story of the nightingale, about an emperor's preference for an artificial songbird over the unmatchable beauty of the real thing. Today's episode is from Hans Christian Andersen's Repertoire of Fairy Tales, originating in 1843. The tales on this podcast are dark, sometimes scary, and full of adult themes. Please exercise caution for children under 13. The nightingale warns of the dangers of disconnecting from reality and leaves us with a bittersweet ending. And the story characterizes death as a terrifying monster. If you want to hear more tales, you can find episodes on your favorite podcast directory. While you're there, feel free to make our day by leaving a 5-star review. A new episode will release every other Saturday, so if you enjoy it, subscribe. The Nightingale is believed to be an ode to Andersen's unrequited love, Jenny Lind. Jenny was a famous singer and soon came to be known as the Swedish Nightingale. Though he hoped to have a romantic relationship with her, she wrote of him, "May, quote, God bless and protect my brother is the sincere wish of his affectionate sister," end quote. Many critics believe it's an oversimplification, though, to read The Nightingale as a tale solely about a love that would never be returned. The story is also as much about life and death as it is about love and loyalty. It reminds us that natural beauty can only come from within. May carefully entered the kitchen through the rear entry, making sure not to slam the door behind her, and found Lou and Anne mid-argument. May tried to make herself scarce by hiding behind a large mixing bowl, but she was unable to escape whatever it was that had upset Lou that morning.
"See?"
he exclaimed at Anne, who was already ignoring him.
"May doesn't slam the door, and do you know why?"
He paused, hoping for an answer, but soon gave in.
"Porcelain! The palace is made out of porcelain. Very delicate, very fragile, very expensive porcelain. So much so that even a single cracked door handle could cost you your life. And even that, frankly, would not cover the expense."
Anne continued rolling dough and simply replied, "Anything else?"
Lou huffed angrily. Yes, I must borrow the girl.
Then he turned to May and gestured for her to follow him. She stalled for a moment. She wasn't supposed to leave the scullery, and looked to Anne for guidance. Anne offered her a reassuring look. May followed Lou through the palace. Neither of them exchanged a word. May liked to believe that Lou was once a kind man, and that his years of serving as the Emperor's top aide and right-hand man had gone to his head. But as she followed his quick stomps through the labyrinthine palace, May wasn't so sure. May had never seen so much of the palace before, and her amazement grew with each corner turned. Gold and burgundy tapestries made from the finest, shimmering threads lined the corridors, and life-sized, elegant statues gestured toward the door. But none of the beauty inside the palace came close to the sheer splendor of the palace gardens. Rows and rows of the most brilliantly colored exotic flowers surrounded May. She had never seen so much color. She tried to remain calm, but she couldn't help but let out a small gasp of shock.
"It's beautiful," she said.
Lou looked down his nose at her with condescension.
"I'll be sure to pass along your compliments to the Emperor," he said dryly. "But in the meantime, we have a very important task. The Emperor has made sure his gardeners have put the utmost care into growing the world's finest flowers, and he wants everyone to know it."
May listened as she intently took in what, rest assured, were indeed the finest flowers anyone had ever seen.
"Your job is to hang these little bells on the most exquisite of the bunch, so that when people pass, the little bells will ring and the superior arrangements in his garden will receive the attention they deserve."
"But why me?"
May muttered.
"Why?" he snapped. "Because our gardeners are on another special assignment, if that's all right with you. Or are you too busy scrubbing pots to help serve the wishes of your majesty?"
May timidly shook her head no, and he shoved a basket at her, which clanked when she took it from him. And with that, Lou was gone, leaving her alone to her work. It was hard at first for May to choose and not just hang a bell on every gorgeous blossom. Soon she was so entrenched in her task, she didn't hear anyone else come up behind her. May was startled at the sound of a young man clearing his throat nervously beside her.
"I'm sorry, miss. I didn't mean to frighten you. I've got a delivery for the Emperor."
He handed May a parcel wrapped in brown paper, and before she could redirect him to the palace or say much of anything at all, he was gone. Puzzled, May studied the package and then realized she better get it inside before there was any trouble. Inside the palace, May rushed to bring the package to the Emperor's aides. She had no idea what was inside, and therefore had no way of knowing how important it was. She decided it was best to assume it was of the utmost importance. May had been so distracted by the ornate decorations in the corridors that she had not kept very good track of how to get around the palace and quickly lost her way. The longer she held the package in her hands, the more her palms perspired, for she feared the consequences of keeping the Emperor waiting for his expected package. Finally, she came around a corner and saw an entryway she hadn't yet gone down, and she rushed through the open door right into the Emperor's court. Everyone immediately turned to look at the lost kitchen maid. May's face flushed furiously from embarrassment. Everyone stared at her. In this elite, secluded room, she did not have permission to exist. She dropped her head and averted her eyes.
"What are you doing in here?"
hissed Lou.
I...
May stammered, but she could not find the words.
"She has come bearing a gift," the Emperor observed evenly.
May couldn't help notice that he seemed more intrigued than angered by her surprising entrance, and he beckoned her to bring the package to him. Frozen in her spot, Lou had to nudge her forward, reluctantly allowing May to hold the court's attention as she handed off the package to the Emperor. He quickly discarded the wrapping to reveal a book with golden pages bound in beautiful leather.
The Emperor skimmed through the pages, a twinkle forming in his eyes. His smile grew broader with every turn of the page.
It is a tome written by the most worldly travelers, extolling the superior beauty and grandeur of my kingdom. It is said here many times over that the land I rule is the loveliest land of all.
He handed the book to Lu and gestured for him to read. Lu turned to a random page and read aloud,
"The rivers and lakes are so blue, one could not tell where the water ended and the sky began. And even at night, the shimmer of the stars do shine brightest above the Emperor's palace."
The Emperor nodded with great satisfaction at hearing the praises of his kingdom, as the court applauded in agreement with the traveler's description.
"More, more!" demanded the Emperor.
So Lu turned ahead some dozen pages and took up his reading again.
"Deep in the woods, one can hear the most beautiful song, sung by a darling little bird. The melody is so sweet, it will make your heart dance. It is no question, this bird, the nightingale, is the greatest wonder of all the Emperor's land."
"Nightingale!" barked the Emperor. "What is this nightingale? How have I never heard tell of this creature? Am I not the master of all my land? How could something so notable, so treasured to the outside world, go unnoticed?"
Lu assured the Emperor that he had never heard of such a creature, and the rest of the court shook their heads along with him in agreement.
"Oh, but she's..."
May opened her mouth to speak, but Lu glared at her angrily as he slammed the book shut in one hand.
"Your Excellency," Lu interjected, "you cannot simply believe everything on the page, for sometimes it is only fiction or the work of the black arts."
"Nonsense," cried the Emperor. "This great volume of work was sent here by the Emperor of Japan, endorsed by the honorable man himself, and I will not believe it contains a falsehood."
The irritated Emperor leaned in towards Lu and said,
"I will hear this nightingale sing before my court this evening. I too will enjoy the sweetest melody. My heart will dance. And if my court fails to bring this bird before me by the time supper is through, I will have you all trampled to death out in the fields."
The Emperor raised a menacing eyebrow at Lu, and then turned slowly to address the rest of the court.
"Have I made myself clear?"
We'll return to our story in just a moment. And now, let's continue our story. At the Emperor's threat, the court dispersed most quickly. A chill came over Mei, and in the hallway she saw a cloaked figure lurking among the statues. Mei recognized the figure of Death, which sometimes came to her cabin at night and peered through the windows when her mother's fever burned dangerously hot. The Emperor had threatened to have his horses trample his own court if the nightingale did not sing for him that evening, and Death could not help himself. He had come to make his presence known. There he would wait, running an icy finger along the wall of the hallway, hoping to make himself useful. Mei was jarred back to the matter at hand when Lu rushed out the door with such haste that he knocked her down.
"Wait,"
she called after him.
"I can tell you..."
But he cut her off.
"I think you've done enough this morning. Now I must attend to very important business for the Emperor."
Lu rushed off down the hall, and Mei brushed herself off and ran after him.
"Please wait, listen,"
she called. He was about to scold her and dole out an extremely harsh punishment.
"I know where she is,"
Mei cried.
"Who?"
Lu snapped.
"The nightingale."
At this, Lu turned slowly on his heel to examine Mei.
"Tell me how you know. Surely you're not spending your time in the same places as these exotic travelers. How could you know where this bird is?"
Mei tried to explain herself clearly.
"My mother is very ill, you see,
and I'm allowed to bring kitchen scraps to her after work in the evenings. But we live deep in the forest, very far from any regular paths, and...
Lou cleared his throat impatiently. May nervously jumped to the point.
On my walks in the morning and in the evenings, I always pass a grove where the nightingale perches and...
Lou suddenly grabbed her by the arm and started to yank her down the hall.
Lead me there!
The horse-drawn carriage raced to the edge of the green field and stopped just at the edge of the forest.
We'll have to travel by foot from here. The path is not well paved.
Lou looked out at the vast forest before him, warily. He had not planned for such a laborious afternoon, but the sun was already quite high in the sky, and soon it would be setting. He had a duty to fulfill and needed to muster on. Lou stumbled a bit over the brambles underfoot. He tried to hide his clumsiness, not to be outdone by a kitchen girl. He followed May awkwardly along the woodland footpath. As the two waded into the woods, the trees above blocked out the light, and all around them the forest was very dark. Lou jerked his head towards the sound of distant humming.
There! I think I can hear her. We must be very close,
Lou said.
But May shook her head with a small smile.
No, that's just the sound of cows mooing.
Then there! Surely that's her!
Exclaimed Lou.
That's just the frogs croaking down by the stream,
May replied.
Trust me, the sound of our bird is much more exquisite than any of these.
But Lou looked on skeptically as he followed her down the ever-darkening trail. Then May turned off of the trail onto a smaller, less even path. Lou wanted to protest, but May had gotten ahead of him already, so he followed her. As he did so, he heard the most wondrous song. He locked eyes with May, who gave him a slight nod, for neither of them wanted to speak and interrupt the melody. May pointed up into the trees and waved for Lou to come stand beside her so he too could have a look at the bird. Once the bird paused her song, Lou said,
"How strange it is that such a lovely song could come from such a simple-looking thing."
He examined the nightingale silently, a look of disappointment on his face, for she was very small in size. Her feathers did not stand out like the crimson cardinal or the golden canary, but instead she was gray as a simple kitchen mouse. But her looks belied her song. He took a step forward, clearing his throat before saying,
"Little nightingale bird, your song is ever so charming, and the court of the emperor wishes for you to sing before his majesty this evening."
The bird swooped down and landed on May's outstretched finger, as if by enchantment the little bird spoke.
"I do believe my song sounds best in the forest, but I am honored by your invitation, and I accept."
Lou and May looked to one another and grinned. Then they agreed they must move quickly to return in time for the emperor's supper. May and Lou returned to the palace with the nightingale perched on May's shoulder. Lou led her right into the emperor's court, and when they stepped into the room, not a single head turned to notice them. The room buzzed with anticipation and anxiety. Everyone was much more focused on themselves and their own failure to produce the bird. Though they all hoped someone had been successful and would save them all from being trampled to death. Lou pushed May through the bustling group towards the emperor's throne, but no one paid her much attention. She was elbowed and jostled, and then the little gray bird on her shoulder began to sing. At first, no one noticed, but the bird kept singing, and soon she grew louder, and her song grew sweeter. A hush fell over the room, and the crowd parted so that May could make her way across the great hall to the emperor. May nervously stepped before the emperor upon his grand throne and bowed before him. The little gray bird hopped from May's shoulder and perched herself right on the left hand of the emperor, who placed his other hand upon his heart. The bird finished her song and the group applauded.
The bird cocked her head and looked up at the emperor as a single tear escaped his eye.
"A song like yours must truly be sent from the heavens above," he cried out. "You must receive a medallion of my thanks."
And he presented her a small gold pendant for her to wear around her neck.
"There is no need, Your Majesty," said the bird, "for I have seen tears in the emperor's eyes, and an emperor's tears have a wonderful power, and that alone is honor enough for me."
"Then you must stay with us and always share your beautiful song. After hearing it once, I want to hear no other song."
"As you wish," said the little bird,
and with that she picked up her tune again, to the amazement of the court. May felt quite relieved that the nightingale's arrival was a success. She smiled to herself, watching out the window as the cloaked figure of death wandered away from the palace, defeated for today. The crowd then turned to May and offered her their highest praise. They shook her hands and bowed their thanks to her. In the shuffle, she lost track of Lu, and no one said a word about him. The royal court thanked May by giving her a more prominent role in the kitchen and promising as much food to bring home to her ailing mother as she could carry. Thanks to this nightingale, she'd never want for anything again. There was much fanfare over the arrival of the nightingale. A golden perch was built and installed beside the emperor's throne for her. She sat by his side and sang all day, many different songs, each one sweeter than the last. The emperor was so pleased that he spent less time with his court and wanted merely to sip his tea and listen adoringly to the songbird. A certain calm fell over the whole palace for everyone except Lu, who was envious of the attention the bird received and angry that he too had not been given the same praise as May. So he hid in his quarters, toiling away on a new gift in order to make sure that he would not be outshined as the emperor's top aide, not by a scullery maid, and not by a simple gray bird. Finally satisfied with his project, he presented to His Majesty.
"Your Highness,"
Lu said one morning, interrupting the nightingale mid-melody,
"I have something, a gift, to present to you before the court."
Lu proudly held the parcel, which was covered in a shiny gold kerchief. He knew that the emperor was quite fond of gifts and would be most pleased with what he was about to receive. Lu waited as the emperor called for his court's full attention. Once Lu was sure he had everyone's attention, he stepped before the throne and bent on one knee before his audience. With a dramatic flourish, he pulled back the kerchief to reveal a wind-up bird.
"What's this?" exclaimed the emperor. "Another songbird!"
This bird, which was made out of pure gold and speckled with jewels and diamonds, shimmered and sparkled in the afternoon sunlight. It was no easy task for Lu to acquire such gems, but he had called on many favors in order to present the emperor with a far superior songbird, one whose beauty properly matched its surroundings. Under one wing, there was a key on this bird, and Lu reached up to wind it. He wound it slowly and relished in the emperor's rapt attention. Everyone held their breath, waiting for what was to come next. Finally, when he released the key, the bird sprang to life and sang a brand new song that no one had ever heard before.
"What a lovely treat!" cried the emperor. "We must have the two birds sing together."
They placed the wind-up bird beside the nightingale and wound the key to start the song again. The wind-up bird began on cue, but the emperor gestured the nightingale to join in. When the nightingale joined in, though, it was not quite the harmonious duet the crowd was hoping for. It was a cacophony of clashing notes and competing melodies that echoed across the great hall like a band playing broken instruments. The nightingale always sang an original melody from her heart, while the wind-up bird sang only waltzes, and the two could not find a harmony. This caused much confusion and disappointment among the court. The new bird was surely more attractive than the nightingale, but their songs were very different.
"You mustn't let it bother you that the wind-up bird sings only one song,"
Lou argued before the mood could sour against his gift.
"The nightingale always sings a different song, but the wind-up bird will always be the same. A sure thing. And the rest of the kingdom will be able to learn the song as well and keep it with them in their minds, even when they are away from the bird."
The emperor nodded, for this all seemed smart and true to him. He was also very fond of the bird's elegant beauty.
"It is decided," the emperor declared. "This new bird shall hold the seat of royal songbird in place of the nightingale."
Lou then quickly swept the little gray bird off of her golden perch with one hand and placed the golden songbird there instead. The nightingale took flight and circled around the great hall.
"My songs are inspired by the beauty and the sadness of the world. They tell the stories of humans and their suffering and their joy. It is the fault of the listener if he cannot appreciate that gift, not the fault of the singer. And the listener will miss out. He will suffer."
And she gave one last mournful song as she flew away out the window.
"Is that a threat?" cried the emperor. "I will not be so disrespected in my own court. If that bird is going to flee in such a fashion, I want it known in all of the kingdom that she is banished from my palace forever."
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network. And now, back to Tales.
Years passed, and still only the song of the wind-up bird was allowed on the palace grounds. Everyone in the court and who served the palace was made to memorize its song. Many delighted in the tune at first, and soon many found it quite tiresome, while others were driven to madness by its repetition. Then one day, as the emperor reached to wind up his songbird once more, a spring inside the mechanical creature broke loose. The court called upon Lou, the wind-up bird's creator, to come fix it. He took the bird away to his quarters and tinkered with it all day and night. But the inner workings and mechanisms were all so fragile that he could not fix one without damaging another. Though the bird could still play, its song stuttered and had a new, unnatural ding to it. Lou returned the bird to the court with an anxious knot in his stomach. How could he face the entire kingdom after letting the emperor down? Lou wasn't sure he could bear the shame of disappointing his majesty. For even though the emperor was tough and particular, he was greatly beloved throughout the kingdom, and everyone took great pride in serving him. He stood before the emperor and presented the bird.
"Your majesty," he said, "the wind-up bird is in a very delicate state, and I fear she may never be as good as new."
The emperor was quiet for a very long time considering this. Beads of nervous perspiration formed across Lou's forehead. The court looked on, wide-eyed in anticipation as well. Finally, the emperor spoke.
"And what does my top aide recommend for the bird?"
Lou looked up, surprised to still have the support of his emperor. He straightened himself up and cleared his throat.
"Perhaps the bird's song should be preserved and only played on the most special of occasions," Lou said, matter-of-factly.
And the emperor nodded and smiled. The emperor loved this idea, and he believed this actually made the bird even more special. It was then declared that this songbird could only be wound once per year so as to preserve it from further damage. Lou was relieved that he had narrowly avoided utter disgrace and stepped back from the public eye, vowing not to let his jealousy get the better of him in the future.
Soon after the announcement, the emperor took ill and was confined to his quarters, trying to recover. This was not an average cold. No, a white-hot fever overtook his mind, and a deep, impenetrable chill sank into his bones. All of his aides worried that this might be the end of their dear emperor. Soon an unshakable chill set into the palace. The groundskeepers and the kitchen aides felt the cold stiffness in their hands, and no matter how many fires burned in the palace fireplaces, no one could ward off the frigid drafts that swept through the halls. May knew that even though she hadn't seen him, death had moved into the palace, and along with him came this terrible cold spell. One evening, May passed through the woods on her way home, but stopped for a rest when she heard the song of the nightingale once again. The bird sailed through the treetops, singing playfully to herself, and when she finished her song, May clapped.
"You always did have the loveliest songs," she called to the bird.
The nightingale landed on the log beside May.
"Thank you for your kind words," she said. "It's good to see you again."
May put out her finger and the bird hopped up.
"It's good to see you too," said May. "The palace misses you a great deal."
And May told the nightingale about how the new wind-up bird broke down and about how the emperor had become so sick that death moved into the palace.
"Oh my," said the nightingale. "What terrible news to hear. Perhaps I shall pay the emperor a visit."
"I think he would like that very much," said May as she stood from the log.
"I must be going," she said, "but I hope the palace will see you again soon."
And the little gray bird took flight once more and sailed off into the darkened sky. That evening, as the emperor lay in bed, body aching, pale and cold, he felt a strange weight on his chest. The heaviness pressed his lungs together, squeezing the breath out of him. He gasped and opened his eyes to see the ugly face of death staring directly into his eyes. Cloaked in black robes that were tattered at the hood and sleeves, death leaned forward. The weight of his presence grew heavier on the emperor's chest, now closing up his throat. The emperor tried in vain to push death away, but death only leaned in closer, bringing his sunken eyes and rotted face directly before the emperor's. A wilted gray hand rose up from under the tattered robes, and death snapped its cold, pale fingers. Disembodied heads began to roll into the emperor's bedroom. Colorless faces with blank eyes and lolling tongues tumbled across the floor. The emperor grappled with death, still aching for a fresh breath of air, but he could only gasp weakly under the weight. Death raised an arm, and with it rose a dozen heads that floated above the emperor, taunting him.
"Remember,"
hissed Death, leaning closer to his ear. But the emperor tried to hide his gaze, for these heads represented all the terrible, evil things he had done in his life. The emperor turned his head away and found there were some heads that represented the good things he had done, but they were much fewer in number. He began to weep and tried to reach for the music bird sitting beside his table.
"I don't want to hear it," he croaked. "Sweet songbird, drown out the terrible memories."
But he could not reach the key. He wept as his breathing grew shallow. The heads of his evil deeds grew larger and filled the room around him. Bodiless, bouncing, rotting heads. They blurred his vision and sucked the breath out of him. The nightingale sailed by the emperor's bedroom window and saw the terrible scene inside. She landed on the windowsill and began to sing. Suddenly, Death turned to the window where the little gray nightingale was perched, carrying with it a brand new song. Beneath its own weight, Death felt the emperor's heart dance in his chest. And Death felt a small hint of warmth return to the dying Emperor. The bird stopped singing when Death turned his gaze to her in shock.
"More," hissed Death.
But the bird just fluttered her wings and said,
"You must lay down your sword and your tools of destruction."
Death weighed the offer and soon set down his tools. In return, the nightingale then sang a melody so bittersweet that Death eased his grasp on the Emperor. Her song was full of beautiful imagery as she sang of white roses that grew in a churchyard. There, the breeze carried the sweet-smelling perfume of the roses to any mourners who visited. The mourners took in the lovely scene of roses as they held one another and wept for the loved ones they had lost. The nightingale sang of how the mourners' tears fell upon the churchyard and watered the grass and the roses. Her song captivated Death. He had to see this scene for himself and quickly slid from the room, the dozens of bloodless heads vanishing along with him.
"Sweet bird," cried the Emperor, who was now a rosier color than he had been in weeks. "You have saved me from death. How did you know?"
"Your Majesty, I hear your cries deep in the woods, for an emperor's tears are quite powerful after all. I shall never forget what joy your tears gave me as thanks for my song."
"Will you stay? You can have a nest grander than anything you've ever seen, and you can sing whenever you want, any song you desire," he said. "You will be held in the court's highest esteem."
"No, I cannot stay and build my nest here," answered the bird. "I need no great displays of adoration to share my song with you, for I love your heart better than your crown."
The Emperor looked on with a bit of sadness in his eyes, and she added,
"But know that I will visit again. I will sing for my Majesty, and it will be our secret, our own private moments," she said. "Now sleep. You must rest and regain your strength."
The Emperor dozed off to sleep. In the morning, several members of his court entered, fearful that he did not live through the night. All were delighted when the Emperor sat up in the morning sun and happily greeted them all. His heart was full, for now he understood that true beauty was something you carried inside of you, that you could not contain it or parade it about, but that you must love it and honor it all the same. He sat amongst his court, a new day upon them, and off in the distance, if one listened closely, the nightingale could be heard singing to herself over the palace. This mystical tale offers an insightful message about true beauty and the importance of honoring art and nature. It is a bit of a warning to its listeners as well, reminding them that they must shed their egos in order to form truly genuine connections and find real joy in the world, just the way it is. It cautions listeners against falling for shallow or inauthentic messages that might be dressed up in fashionable but empty packages. Thanks for listening to Tales. If you want to listen to more tales, you can find us and subscribe on your favorite podcast directory or listen on Parcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, we'd truly appreciate a 5-star review. We'll see you next time. Tales was created by Max Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Tales is written by Lisa Fry. I'm Vanessa Richardson.